This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Victims of domestic violence sometimes face an additional challenge, how to keep their pets safe. Animal cruelty can also be a sign that the perpetrator is acting violently towards a spouse or partner and their children too. Harbour House of Central Florida has a kennel to house pets, and that can help remove one of the barriers that stands in the way of someone trying to leave an abusive relationship. This month, Harbour House is highlighting the link between domestic abuse and animal cruelty. Well, Michelle Spurzel, CEO of Harbour House, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on today.
So there's a connection between domestic abuse, domestic violence, and cruelty to animals.
Mm-hmm.
Explain those connections there and why is it important to the work that you're doing specifically this month?
Sure. So this is Animal Cruelty Month, and the connection that we see is that oftentimes batters use animals against the people who are living in the household. So it might be that the batters are using the animals as far as coercive control, and it's to say, you know, I'm going to hurt the animal, and that's a threat to the person. And it could be a child, it could be an adult. And it's also something that they do as far as to make good on their threats. And so not only are they using it, but they're also then hurting the animal, and then the person sees that their animal is being hurt. Or they let the dog off the leash and the dog runs away, and then they never get their dog back. And some of the cases of animal cruelty that I've seen in the work doing domestic violence have been, I mean, some of them have been absolutely awful, like cats coming in that were burnt with curling irons. One cat was thrown through the front window and came in with multiple cuts. Another dog, the reason why I started a domestic violence shelter for animals on our campus at my other center is the fact that we had someone who had her German Shepherds. She'd left them at home. She came in. We weren't a pet-friendly organization at the time. And so when she called home to check on her dogs, her abuser shot in one of them and killed one of the dogs while she was on the phone. And there was nothing we could do, because that's when we found out that dogs are property.
How new is the research into these connections between domestic violence and animal cruelty? Is this something that people have known for a long time? Is it something that you're kind of piecing together as you go along?
So it's something that's been more correlated with child abuse. And then since there's abuse happening in the home, then people are looking to see, is there also domestic violence happening? And so there's been campaigns that have happened across the United States and also worldwide. Australia is one that had a really big push. And it's that if you see any type of animal abuse happening in the home, most likely there's some sort of other abuse happening, be it child abuse, be it sexual abuse, be it domestic violence. And so that's why it's really important that people know that there is a correlation, so that if you do see a dog that's chained up outside and it's incessantly barking, or you notice that there's a dog that's outside who is not getting fed, that is just a red flag of something's happening within that family, that, you know, it's okay for you to call law enforcement to say, hey, we know that there's animal cruelty. A lot of times people won't want to come into a domestic violence center because they don't want to leave their pets behind. I have my animals, and I can't imagine leaving them behind with someone who I know is emotionally and physically hurting me, because I know that person's going to hurt my family members. And so by having the kennel on site, we're able to help people bring their animals in. And it's twofold. One, we're saving the lives and possible injury to the animals. And then also having your pet with you provides some normalcy, but that unconditional love that you get from your pet and that your pet receives from you, that is transformational. And that's when people really can start healing from trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Even the dogs and the cats and, you know, the birds that we have come in, like, we notice a difference, or the owner, we don't notice them, but the owner says, you know, they're so much calmer now, or they are not acting the same as they were at home because the anxiety is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, like, I would say the two big things that we're able to do when we're working with someone who's experiencing domestic violence and we know there's animal cruelty happening.
So it helps the people you're working with too. It's a sense of normalcy, such mm-hmm. as there can be, because they
right.
have a pet with them. And
yeah, they have the pet. They have a little bit of a routine. So part of it is that you wake up, you go and take your dog for a walk, or if someone's coming in with their kids, that's another piece where it's really important, because, you know, there's that special bond between the family pets and also the kids. And so they're able to go and play ball, spend time. We have a futon that's in the cat room so people can take cat naps with their cats. And that's important, like that healing of the purr that your cat's going to be giving you. So it's definitely twofold. I mean, having the animals there on site is so important for that someone starting to heal from trauma they've experienced.
How long have you had the kennel at Harbor House?
The kennel's been around for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so it's been there for a while, and we are constantly looking to see how it's used for us to be able to make improvements to it. And it also depends on how many animals we have. Right now we have four large dogs in the kennel, and you know, we want to make sure that we can have kennel space, so because they are family dogs, mm-hmm. and so I mean by that, like, they have their own pack. The way that our kennel is set up right now is each one of those dogs, they're in their own separate kennel, and so one of the improvements is to create a space so that if we do have a pack come in, they can spend some time together as mm-hmm. well, and that's important because they're bonding as well.
Do you have a vet on staff?
We don't, but we have partnerships with a lot of different vets in the local area. And some of the vets help with different things. So one might be that they help with preventative. So if someone brings their pet in and we look at their vet records and we know they haven't gotten vaccines, we're able to help them get that twofold. It's for the safety of the other animals in the kennel, but also it's to get that pet up to speed with their different vaccinations. And then also when we have an animal that does come in injured, it's really important that we have those vet relationships. So sometimes someone comes into emergency shelter and we take their animal immediately to an emergency vet if it's at night, or we take them to a local vet that we have a partnership with to make sure that that pet can start getting medical treatment right away. Mm-hmm. And the relationships we have are fantastic, and we know that it makes a huge difference, especially when someone doesn't know what to do and they literally are fleeing with their animal. To know that they're going to be able to take care of them is just another burden removed.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Michelle Spurzel. She's the CEO of Harbor House, talking about the connections between animal cruelty and domestic violence. So, Michelle, what's it like for the staff at the shelter? Do they enjoy having that extra kind of responsibility, I guess, of managing a kennel as well as helping out the folks who are living at the shelter?
So we have one person that's her main job, and she is our kennel coordinator. And she absolutely loves it. She used to work for a veterinarian's office, and so she's very protective of it and of the program. And the answer is yes. I mean, everybody does appreciate it because of the fact that we see the transformation of someone who's able to go up there and spend time with their pet. And then the other piece along with that is to know that we're saving the lives of the animals that are coming in. And mm-hmm. so there, I guess one of the things that we talk about a lot is we talk about keeping the entire family together. And so that means, you know, the non-abusing parent, the kids, and then also the pets. And to be able to provide that service to someone who's coming in is amazing. And when someone comes into or is even calling for help on our crisis hotline, that's one thing we talk about is we ask, are there any pets in the house? And people who aren't ready to leave we know that they're not going to leave that abusive situation, one thing we do is we do a pet safety plan with them. So making sure that, one, if you do decide to leave, make sure that the vet records, you have copies of them, and also that your name's on those vet records, because it's important to prove that you are the person who's been the main caretaker of that animal if you ever decide to leave with that animal. Otherwise, you know, abuser can accuse you of theft, especially if it's a purebred animal or it's a show dog or something of that nature, or if it's a breeding pet. Mm-hmm. So that's something we talk about is pet safety planning. We also talk about making sure that if your pet is injured, where are you going to take them or her? What are you going to do in that situation? And then also, if you do decide to leave, what are the different things that you need to take, not just for you, not just for your kids, but also what do you need to take and pack for your pet as well?
So is it a sign also for the folks who are taking these calls of how ready somebody is
yeah.
to leave a domestic abusive relationship and kind of how you all can proceed to help that person out?
Absolutely. And you brought up a really good point. There's the opposite side as well, is that someone who's calling in who is talking through their domestic violence situation and talking about domestic abuse and the type of abuse that's happening. When we say, is there an animal in the house? Has that animal ever been injured by your abuser? To get that perspective and how that is escalation of violence in the home is kind of a click for someone like, oh, I didn't think about that. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people are only thinking about, you know, abuse against a child, and that's sometimes why people leave, or they are calling to verify what they think is happening to themselves. But when you start talking about the entire household and what's happening, that's when some people understand that the violence in their home is starting to escalate.
Mm-hmm. So how common is it for domestic violence shelters to have accommodations for pets as well?
I am happy to say that it's absolutely growing. When I started doing this work, which was almost 11 years ago, there was just a handful of domestic violence centers across the United States, and there were only three here in Florida, mm-hmm. and there's 42 domestic violence centers here in Florida. And I would say right now there's probably half of the domestic violence centers here have the shelters. When I opened my other one, I was up in the Panhandle, and I was the only domestic violence shelter from Louisiana to Destin, Florida, which is where I was. And so if you think about how long that distance is, we were the only pet shelter at that time. And since then, there's been a lot more domestic violence centers that have added this mm-hmm. Much-needed service to survivors and to their pets, which is great because it just – and then also what I think is really interesting is it's not just what's happening with the shelters. It's the laws that are starting to change. And so we're seeing more cruelty to animal laws that are changing. We're seeing that sometimes in some states that pets can be written into the injunctions. So for injunctions for protections that you can write your animal in there that the abuser can't come near your animal as well because they've been part of the domestic violence. And so that's a trend that we're seeing because it is so closely related and that animals are definitely being seen as family members.
Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned before that you learned something interesting about the law in that pets are considered property.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that needs to change at all, do you think?
So I would say personally, me, yes, it needs to change because of the fact that if we're going to change violence in our community, we have to stop looking at things as objects. And I'm going to even say women in that as well. And so when we really address things as that it is its own thing, its own person, and then there's less ownership of another person over that object. And so that's why I would say yes.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation that, you know, if people see signs of animal cruelty, animal abuse, then it's okay to obviously go to authorities, whether it's the animal welfare folks in your area or police and say, look, there's something happening here, you should check it out.
Mm-hmm.
What's the sort of checklist you give people to look out for? What are you telling people to look out for?
So if you're looking for abuse in a family, and if we're going to start with animal abuse, one of them would be if you see an animal that seems to be neglected or groups of animals that are neglected. And so it might be that they're tied to a tree, you're noticing that they're losing weight, that they're unattended and the owners are gone for long periods of time. So those would be big ones. Another one that we're going to be talking about when it comes to domestic violence in the home, and it might be someone that you know, would be a change in their attitude or the fact that they're isolating themselves more and more. Someone who you know had a very high sense of self and self-esteem, and you're noticing that that's been chipped away more and more. Someone who says that they have to ask their partner for permission for things that might not make sense to you. So I might be like, you know, I want to go buy a cup of coffee. And they're like, oh, I have to ask, you know, if that's okay. And you know that they don't have budget issues. And so you're like, well, why does she have to ask permission? Or why does he have to ask permission in order to purchase something that's maybe $2.50?
Mm-hmm.
So those are different things that you can think of at the back of your mind. And because it's more than just physical. I mean, a lot of people are going to point to you know, obviously if a dog has an injury that's unexplained or if a person has bruises that are unexplained or a child does, people notice those. But the domestic violence is so much more subtle. And if you are really looking at a family and you see some of those other signs, then there most likely is a bigger issue.
Because it's not always physical.
No, it's not always physical. It's going to be emotional. It's going to be psychological. It's going to be financial. It could be spiritual. And that's why it's important that people know kind of the full cycle of domestic violence and they're able to reach out to friends and family members if they think someone is experiencing it. And another thing I would say would be that when someone does reach out, so if you have a friend who says, you know, this is what I'm experiencing right now, to be completely open and accepting and do your best to not tell that person what you think that they should do, because it is so hard and it takes so much courage to tell that first person that I think this is what's happening, and you can just affirm, you know, like, I've been concerned about that for a little bit as well. What can I do to help? Mm-hmm. And then also always know that you can call a domestic violence center, and the state hotline here in Florida is 1-800-500-1119, and advocates can help put someone in touch with a domestic violence center that's closest to them in order to get them into services that might be outreach services or court services or even into shelter.
Just back to the domestic violence shelters in Florida that have pet accommodations too, and you mentioned that about half of them statewide do. What about in Central Florida? Are there a lot where folks, if they have a pet, they can bring it with them? Are you the main one in this area?
Yeah, we're going to be the main one here in the local area. Our sister centers here in Central Florida, which would be Safe House of Seminole and Osceola, they don't actually have the kennels yet. They've been talking about it, which, you know, I'm in full support of them being able to start that program. And so right now we are the ones that are the main ones here in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm. And that would mean you would be a popular destination, I imagine.
Yes. And again, because we're helping remove that barrier. And it's been interesting, some of the different people who end up coming in, specifically because we do have the pet program. One woman who comes to mind, she is a truck driver. And so she came in because she knew that was going to be something that she needed in order to get away from her abuser. We've had women who have come in that didn't know that we had the service, but when we are doing the screening over the phone and we ask if there's pets, she didn't even think about the fact that would be a difficulty coming into a shelter and not being able to bring her pets. So it's something that is so needed.
Now, you've got an event coming up this coming weekend to bring awareness to the connections between domestic violence and animal abuse. Tell me a little bit about this event.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the 20th, so Saturday, April 20th, in the morning at 8 o'clock, we're going to be having our Pause for Peace walk. It's our 9th annual walk, which is amazing. It's going to be at Baldwin Park, and it's $30 for people if they want to register prior to 35, the day of. And the event is to raise money and awareness about our program, so about the Pause for Peace kennel, and then also about animal abuse and domestic violence and how it is correlated. And it's a great event. One, it's one of those where whenever you involve pets, people just, you know, bring out their best. I mean, dogs and cats, we don't get that many cats. It's mostly dogs. But they come out, and we're asking everybody to come out in superhero costumes this year. The theme this year is Heart of a Hero, and it's about pets helping other pets. And it's a really quick, just a little bit less than a 1 mile walk around Baldwin Park. And then we have different vendor booths that will be there as well. And because it is Holy Saturday, for people who observe Easter, we are having a Easter egg hunt for the dogs. So that is exciting. It's going to be Easter egg hunt for like little tiny squeaker toys and little tiny treats. I think there's some Easter rubber duckies that are going to be thrown in there. So, yeah.
Sounds like fun. Well, Michelle Spurzel, CEO of Harbor House, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me to come in.
Still to come on Intersection, toxic cane toads are poisoning pets and trashing swimming pools in South Florida, and now they're heading north.
Some of the pools I've been into in the evening, the toads just go in there and it looks like they're having a party. They're under the waterfalls and hanging out at the steps.
Up next, we talk to the Toad Buster. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. An invasive cane toad that first appeared in South Florida is hopping north. According to ABC Action News in Tampa, a bufo toad, which secretes a substance that's toxic to dogs and cats, killed a Tampa woman's dog. Janine Tilford is a high school science teacher who started Toad Busters after she realized there was nothing being done to curb the toxic toads. Tilford says her business is growing as the toad population booms. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm glad to speak with you.
These toads are kind of interesting critters, and I know there's a story to how you got started in this business, because it is not your main line of work, right? You're a teacher, and then this is something that you started because you had a personal experience with the toads. I wonder if you just explain how that all got started.
Well, there's multiple reasons. Originally, I was a veterinary technician, and I used to handle the dogs that come in to the clinic that had been exposed to the toxin, and I realized there was nothing out there to help these people other than rescue the dogs. So kind of in the back of my mind, I was like, you know, this might be something to do in the future. And as I moved along in my career, I I became a teacher and needed to bring in some extra income because teachers don't really make a lot of money. So this seemed to be a good idea to start because I'd be working in the evening. It wouldn't affect my day job. So I started it, and literally in like 2 months, we kind of exploded, and it's just been getting larger and larger every year.
So how long ago did you start Toadbusters?
It's going into its third year.
And have you had to expand your company, like hire some extra staff to deal with the demand?
Yes, we're about 8 technicians at this point.
So if somebody sees a toad in their neighborhood, they want to get rid of it, they give you a call. Are you kind of like Ghostbusters? You show up with the van and the suits and everything. How does that all work?
Actually, pretty much. They call us. We go out in the evening, usually as soon as it gets dark. We'll come out. We're wearing our uniforms. We have LED red vests that are safety vests, more for the safety of the technician. Because we're out at nighttime carrying bags, we've got a headlamp on our head. So, you know, it looks sketchy if we were in plain clothes because we're also carrying a bag. So it looks like somebody might be breaking into a house. So wearing the uniform, it keeps people realizing we are out there to be seen, not to be hiding. And we collect the toads by hand. We don't use toxins. We don't use any traps. You know, we feel that's the safest way for the pets and the people, and it's the most effective way to catch them that I feel. And also, it does not target any native species, which is one of the things that, you know, my company's focused on is improving our native wildlife, not just the invasives.
What happens to the toads once you trap them?
Usually, we have to humanely euthanize them. According to the University of Florida, we do a 20% benzocaine spray on them, which anesthetizes them, puts them to sleep. And then after they're asleep, they go in the freezer for 3 days, and then they can be disposed of.
And has the science of helping pets out when they've come in contact with toads improved at all? Like, are there anti-venoms that vets can give a pet if it's, like, licked a toad or bitten a toad?
There's no anti-venom for them. Basically, what the technicians or the veterinarians do is kind of manage and stabilize the dog. You know, they'll give them fluids to help the toxin pass through better. We wash out the mouth again to make sure that there's no more residual left in the mouth. They're given other medications to control the symptoms, the seizures, the high temperature. And hopefully, you know, with all those interventions, we can get them through the toxin, and they usually, you know, recover within a few hours to, you know, a day or two, unless it's a really bad, and, you know, they get a lot of the toxin.
And you've seen what happens for yourself once a dog, you know, comes in contact with one of these poisonous toads, these venomous toads?
Yeah, actually, you know, I knew about them from forever before I even had dogs. And I trained my Jack Russells not to go after them, but one day one of the cane toads got into my patio, somehow either squeezed in through the doggy door or somebody left the door open, and my dogs went after it. And I turned around and came out of the kitchen, and my little Jack Russell's walking to me very, like, he's looking like he was drunk. I knew right away what he'd gotten into. His gums were red, his eyes were dilated, and I immediately wiped out his mouth, and we went off to the pet emergency clinic. He had gone into a full-blown seizure, almost died, but he survived it, and, you know, he was back home the next day. But it was a very traumatic, scary thing to watch. You know, I always tell people to be prepared for it, because it's time that matters, and if you are panicking, going through the phone book, trying to figure out who to call, you're wasting time. So one of the things that we do when we go out to the clients, we actually go through what to do if your dog were to get into it, so they're prepared and they have a plan. And that way you save time and, you know, have a better chance of saving your dog's life.
How does this toxin work? Why are these toads so dangerous?
Well, the toxin that they carry is extremely potent to animals. It's made in the parotid glands up behind the head, like behind each eye on the side. So you see these big, large glands on each side. So it's made there, but it actually travels through every pore of the toad. So it'll come out through the legs, through the mouth, through the body. So if a dog were to stumble upon it, whether they bit it or not, sometimes the toads can you know, they kind of arch their back and it kind of trickles out the pores. It doesn't really squirt out. Everybody thinks they squirt it out at the pets. That's not the case. Usually what squirts out is urine. They get scared and they kind of pee. And that's the first thing that comes out. That's not any toxin. It's just urine, water mostly. But the white stuff that comes out, if the dog were to put his nose on the toad or step on it or bite it, that toxin immediately sticks to the inside of the mouth or the foot. And if the dog even later on were to lick his foot, maybe even an hour or so after he had, you know, stepped on it, they can get the toxin that way and it can show. So it's an immediate effect. The dog initially starts licking its lips, salivating, shaking its mouth. Gums get really red. The eyes go into full dilation. Dog starts to get hot and pant. And then as the toxin continues through, the dog starts to walk like he becomes drunk or, you know, confused. And then they go into a full-blown seizure. And if they're not treated at that point, eventually all their vital organs start to shut down and the heart shuts down. And it affects the heart after that and it kills them.
The story about these cane toads has been reported on in the Palm Beach Post, and then the story was picked up by The Atlantic. Is the problem worse now than when you started your business, Toad Busters?
It is. It got worse this year, and I think, you know, the problem is right now, and the reason why we're seeing a whole lot more this year is two things. I think, you know, these toads don't have predators, so they're reproducing at a phenomenal rate. I mean, the numbers are increasing greatly, and we didn't have a solid winter this year. We had a very mild winter, and the toads never shut down. Usually from the months of January, February to the beginning of March, we've had cold snaps that make the toads go dormant. The younger toads that were born in October, November, December, usually can't survive during the cold snap because they don't have enough weight and there's not enough insects to feed them. So they usually die off. But because that didn't happen this winter, the ground never got cold enough, they were able to stay warm. The insects were still around. And we didn't lose that group we normally lost. And on top of it, the toads started breeding at the end of January, which was a month earlier than they normally start.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to Janine Tilford. She's the owner of Toad Busters. We're talking about the explosion of these poisonous cane toads in South Florida. Janine, the toads have also been spotted as far north as Central Florida. Are you getting calls from places sort of further out than you can reach with your business?
Well, ultimately, we're planning on reaching everybody. We're focusing on right now South Florida and the East Coast, but I do have multiple calls on the West Coast, and we are heading further up north. So as we can, we're expanding to try to cover and help everybody. But, you know, it's hard to do, you know, as a small company. We're growing extremely fast. I mean, the numbers are amazing and it's great, but also, you know, service is important to me, and providing a company that is, you know, that does what we say we can do, you know, I want to make sure that we're sticking to that. So as much as I would love to expand everywhere, I want to, you know, focus on the areas we're in. And as we get a handle on it, we're, you know, probably every couple months we're increasing or expanding our area, and, you know, more and more techs are starting. And so ultimately I hope Toad Busters will be able to cover all of South Florida, the West Coast, the East Coast, and Central Florida.
Have you thought about the possibility that this could be your full-time gig down the track some ways, or are you always going to be a teacher, do you think?
No, absolutely. It started off part-time, but literally showed me it was going to be a full-time job after the first year. I'm looking to probably eventually stop teaching. I'm going to try to hang in there for another year and just have the company pretty solid. But if things keep growing like they are at the moment, I may have to take a leave of absence next year, depending on whether or not I can, you know, handle all of the calls. It's still at nighttime, so it's still kind of away from my day job, but it is getting to be a lot of work between working, teaching high school, and then doing this. And then I even have a band on the side, and that's that plays 80 gigs a year, so it's starting to be a lot of work for me.
Sounds like you don't have much time for anything else. Janine Tilford, is there any kind of crossover between teaching and the work you do in toad removal? Like, do you talk to your kids, your students, about how invasive species spread and the biology of these toads as well?
Absolutely. I teach environmental science and biology and marine science, and we talk about, I share with them, you know, the excitement of what's going on in my business, not only on the environmental sense, you know, but how I started it and, you know, what drove me to find this business. And we talk about how where the growth's going and show them that, you know, you can actually do things that you love. And you can, if you, you know, put enough time and effort into something and believe in something, you know, don't be afraid to try it, because, you know, this is kind of something I've had in the back of my mind for years and go, you know, I don't think anybody would ever do this. But when I got into it, it was immediate, like an immediate startup. It started so quickly and people were so happy that there was somebody there, because nobody wants to deal with them. People don't want to catch them. They're afraid of them. And like I said, it's growing as we continue to build out west, put in all these great lakes that we like to live on and look pretty. We continually make new habitats for these guys to thrive.
What about swimming pools too?
They do go in the swimming pools. My biggest concern with them, the little guys drown usually. They can't get out and they go into the filter. That's not my concern. My concern is more of when you get the adults in there and they defecate in the pool, and then the bacteria that can build up and things like that is just kind of disgusting. Some of the pools I've been into, in the evening, the toads just go in there and it looks like they're having a party. They're under the waterfalls and hanging out at the steps, and literally there's black spots of poop all over the bottom of the pool and the edges. And, you know, I know the pool guys complain about that because it really messes the pool up.
Doesn't sound too pleasant. Do you know how the toads got their foothold in Florida in the first place? Were they introduced as a pet, or was there some kind of agricultural reason? I know that in Australia, cane toads were brought in for some version of pest control back in the day, and that didn't go so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had two stories about it. Originally, they were brought in, like you said, in Australia, but they were brought in here for the cane grub as well, as a biological pest control. And I guess nobody really looked at the repercussions of these guys being toxic and the fact that the cane beetle flies and the toads can't catch it at that point. So they ended up taking over that way, and they reproduced so fast that, you know, they got out of control fast. So that's one story. The other story was that they were brought in to the pet trade, and a container of them or crate had gotten broken open on the tarmac at the Miami International Airport, and they escaped from there.
And I'm wondering too, Janine, are there some toads that you have to look out for, the good guy toads, so to speak, ones that you don't want to catch by mistake?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a thing that, you know, I focused with on this business, is I love Florida and we have so many awesome species here, but the toads, the cane toads, have like pushed out our native species, the spadefoot and the southern. And I wanted to see if we remove the bufo toads from the area, are these guys coming back? And it's happening. I'm starting to see a huge swing of our native stuff coming back when you take these bufo toads out. And, you know, my fear with some of these other companies or people that collect and just kill the toads, or they put out glue traps that catch, you know, all kinds of species, you're not targeting the one species. You know, you're affecting the native species, which we want to come back because we need them. We need them here, especially if we're taking the other guys out. So, yeah, we definitely want to see our native stuff come back. And as we take the cane toads out, these guys do return back to the area.
So you would also say to folks who are having an issue with these bufo toads, you want to be a little bit careful about who you contact to get rid of them.
Yeah, it just depends on how you feel. My thing is, I love all the animals. I don't like killing anything. And, you know, some of the methods of catching these guys are, you know, to me it's cruel and unusual if they're stuck to a glue trap and they can't get off. And then basically the only way they can get off is if you kill them or rip their skin off, or they're stuck on it for 24 hours or 48 hours in the hot sun stressing out. You know, I've seen birds get stuck in these glue traps that are native. I've seen native snakes that are not toxic to anything or harmful, we need them, get stuck in these glue traps and then they die. And it's, you know, it's not a pleasant death. It's, You know, they're cooking in the sun and stressing out. Can't really remove them off the trap without killing them.
Janine Tilford, is this looking like a busy summer for your business, Toadbusters?
It is already busy, so I'm a little stressed and a little excited because, you know, we are finally getting the communities to get involved in the areas where we needed people to start realizing that they needed service, like on the golf courses and those larger communities with all those ponds. The more we can treat those areas, the faster I can get a handle on the numbers, and we're starting to get calls from those companies. So yeah, we're growing rapidly.
Well, Janine Tilford is the owner of Toadbusters. We've been talking about the invasive Bufo cane toads. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Up next, the HBO smash hit Game of Thrones may be set in a fictional place called Westeros, but it takes its inspiration from historical events. We'll ask Rollins College medieval literature professor Jana Matthews what can be learned from Game of Thrones when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Were you one of the millions of people who watched the premiere for the final season of Game of Thrones? The fantasy series has gained a zealous fan base over its first 7 seasons, and it's worked its way into popular culture. And part of what makes the show work is the source material. That's according to Jana Matthews, Associate Professor of Medieval Literature at Rollins College. Matthews teaches a course based on Game of Thrones, and she says George R.R. Martin, the author of the books the HBO series is based on, looked to medieval history for inspiration. Jana Matthews, welcome to Intersection.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Did you watch the opening episode of Game of Thrones?
Of course I watched the opening episode. In fact, I watched it with my entire class. On Rollins campus, we had a big party and watched the whole festivities.
Were you an early adopter of Game of Thrones?
I was. I mean, I'm a literary historian by trade. And so I'm of course, fascinated by the ways in which pre-modern history is animated in popular culture. So I came to it pretty quickly.
Because it's a fantasy, right? I mean, they have dragons and other stuff, but there are some connections, or there's some inspiration drawn from actual medieval history.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Game of Thrones is kind of, I guess, the genius of Game of Thrones from an academic standpoint is that it's a show that pays homage to the distant past, but also violates the conventions of historical narrative at every turn. And so essentially what it is it's a composite of history's greatest hits. And so in its basic, sort of most basic form, what the show asks or kind of invents or asks what would happen if you put Queen Elizabeth on the same stage as Genghis Khan and Alexander the Great and Joan of Arc, the Vikings and Crusaders, you know, sort of all at the same time and all in the same place.
Is it leaning more on one era of history, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Martin was a medieval aficionado, so he definitely pays a lot of attention and is indebted to medieval and early modern history. And actually, if you flip Westeros, a map of Westeros, upside down, it looks like England and Scotland. So the sort of giving us clues that he's gesturing in particular to those two national histories.
What about the language in the... In the series, and I guess in the books as well.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a ton of different languages that are used in terms of Dothraki and all the kind of like regional dialects that are used by the different kingdoms. And most of those are frankly, you know, invented, you know, are creations, but a lot of them are based on Celtic languages and have their roots from Scandinavian Nordic languages as well. But, you know, obviously we can't understand or translate them.
So tell me about the course that you teach, because you're looking at it as something which kind of fits into the narrative of history, like actual history, but also sort of borrows from popular culture too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a course that examines the source texts of both the books and also the show series. And so we're looking at everything from, you know, from Shakespeare's Othello, you know, Iago, the sort of main antagonist of Shakespeare's play, serves as a direct antecedent to Littlefinger, and we're reading Joan of Arc, you know, which is kind of like a parallel to Brienne of Tarth. And so I think the Game of Thrones, I think the course uses history and literary history as a lens by which to examine some of the manifestations of that in the show.
Mm-hmm. Now, are all the students who take the course coming to it from Game of Thrones, or are some of them coming to it from medieval history and saying, well, I've never watched this show, I've never read the books, but I'm kind of interested in the connections here.
It's kind of a 90-10 split. So the vast majority of them come from Game of Thrones, and I can suck them into medieval literature that way. And then the other 10% are really, really interested in medieval literature. And, you know, maybe I've heard of the show, but haven't had the opportunity to watch it. But most end up watching it kind of, you know, the beginning of the course or right before.
Mm-hmm. When you started watching this series, did you realize it was going to become such a cultural phenomenon? Because it's sort of made its way into every aspect of present day culture, right? I mean, even there was a Game of Thrones poster, a mock-up of a Game of Thrones poster that made it into a cabinet meeting, presidential cabinet meeting at one point. So it's really kind of saturated how we look at everyday life in the 21st century now.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the magic of Game of Thrones. I mean, we like, as in humans, like big stories, and like Star Wars and like Lord of the Rings. I mean, Game of Thrones is an epic. And so while it speaks to these really broad-based, far-reaching quest narratives of that ask big questions about humanity, it also you know, sort of digs deep and asks sort of really probing questions about the human soul. So I think in the same way that Game of Thrones is about, you know, putting every historical or important historical figure on the stage at the same time, it also puts every human, the range of human emotions on the stage at the same time, right? So these are exaggerated versions of greed and lust and anger and frustration, feelings that we all have. And so, you know, Martin and the showrunners are essentially asking, like, well, what happens if those emotions are allowed to run rampant and wild?
Mm-hmm. In your discussions with your class, do you ever sort of spill over into what's happening in the world today?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely. I think one of the things we recently talked about is, you know, the central architectural feature of in Game of Thrones is the wall. And that wall in Game of Thrones is based on Hadrian's Wall, which was a Roman wall that was constructed in what is contemporary Northern England to divide the civilized world from the Scots and the Picts and the heathens and the barbarians that lived up there. Well, I mean, there's lots of conversations now about a wall that is potentially going to be built on the, you know, borders of the United States. And, you know, we've used that occasion to study the medieval narratives about the wall, looking at how it's represented in Game of Thrones, and to think about, you know, what are some of the issues, like who are we trying to keep out, why, you know, what are sort of the implications of building and constructing this, and sort of what are the ideologies that surround it. So that's one of many examples in which popular culture or popular politics makes its way into this course.
How do you make sure that you don't turn every class into a recap of the previous episode or you know, this week's episode, or just get too far down the rabbit hole of Game of Thrones or even other television shows?
Yeah, this course is not a Game of Thrones appreciation course. And I think there's disclaimers in the syllabus, and I say that right out from the get-go. It's not an easy course. I think the average grade in there is about a B-. And so there's absolutely intellectual heavy lifting that is required of students. And I think that you'll never come into my class and watch a full episode. The max you'll ever watch is a clip. And usually I'm using Game of Thrones as sort of a shtick by which to present a particular issue or concept that leads us into a discussion about a source text that takes up that same issue that inspired it. So I think it's pretty easy, and it may require sort of careful negotiation to make sure that you're not having conversations about Game of Thrones, but we're using it as a framework to talk about broader social and broader issues, literary issues that are at play.
Now, there's some students who come into it thinking that that's going to be more on the lines of kind of recapping episode by episode, and then realize it's not, and then pick something else.
I think the attrition rate's pretty low. I mean, this is the fourth or fifth time that I've taught this course. And so maybe the first time people had no idea what was going on and learned very quickly that, like, whoops, you know, this is not a you know, show watching class. Now that people opt in, I mean, I think, you know, rumor and reputation is sort of serves a lot, and people that that enter into this course do so willingly and opt in knowing what they're getting themselves into.
And do you feel like you are converting a lot of your students over to a real interest in the source text, the kind of what was actually going on in medieval England or even before that?
Absolutely. I think what ends up happening is that we're sort of seeing the relationship between the past and the present. And so as students begin to see the way that the past is animated, in this case, in a television show, then they start to have interest in other television shows, such as Vikings, for example, which then in turn leads them backward towards some of the literature and the text. But what I've seen is a profound difference in the classroom in teaching Shakespeare and Chaucer without a contemporary lens. And And the interest level is much, much higher if you can make the connection real and relevant to them today.
Mm-hmm. Has the course changed a lot over the last 5 years?
It has. I think it's gotten – in practice makes perfect. And so as the course evolves, we begin to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And I've also added a lot more kind of experiential activities that to help kind of drive home the points that I'm trying to make about particular particular issues. So one of which I think is probably my favorite has to do with egg babies. And so, Game of Thrones at the center of that narrative is all about lineage. And we don't live in a patrilineal society. And so it's really hard for students to grasp the importance of how dangerous it was to be an heir to the throne. And so mm-hmm. I divide students into houses, give them hard-boiled eggs, babies that they have to keep alive for 48 hours. And that seems easier said than done when, all the other houses are trying to kill your baby. And so for a brief period of time at Rollins campus, we've got eggs being catapulted into Lake Virginia and, knocked off the table and stolen and, ransomed. And activities like that, I think, help students to understand the central issues, both of that permeate medieval literature, but also the show.
Do they take it too seriously sometimes?
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to institute some rules. There was no physical contact because we got a fist fight a couple years ago.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow. Okay. And babies don't fare so well in the actual series, the show, right? I mean, the kids aren't very well treated.
Yeah, right. I mean, children absolutely are kind of viewed as expendable in many senses. And so these babies, too, have a tough time surviving that 48-hour period.
Mm-hmm. Are there any episodes that you just can't watch yourself? You're like, oh, this is too much even for me.
No, never. No, I think one of my favorites is obviously The Red Wedding. That is back in season 3. And it's a gruesome and horrifying and horrible scene to watch, but also one that is pulled from based on two actual events that occurred about 100 years apart in the 15th century in Scotland. And so reading those source texts and talking about them really makes that particular scene and the horrors of it come alive, that it's not just this horrible thing that the showrunners and that Martin invented, but is actually something that people actually did.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever met George R. R. Martin?
I haven't.
So what would be your on the top of your list of questions if you could sit down and have a chat to George R. R. Martin?
I mean, I would love to talk shop with him. I think that not in terms of the questions, but I would probably want to know what his favorite moment or sort of episode from medieval history really kind of served as the crux of the most inspiring point for him to develop this book series.
Mm-hmm. And as somebody who studies medieval literature and knows where he's kind of drawing his material from, do you feel like you have a better sense than maybe some viewers as to where the series is going to end up?
So series 8 is tricky, or the season 8 is tricky, because this is the point where the showrunners depart from the actual book series. So the final book hasn't been released yet. And mm-hmm. so it's very possible and increasingly likely that the book series and the show will end in two different ways. But I think we got some clues about where it may be headed. We have Arya, who has commissioned the construction of a weapon made out of Valyrian steel. So she may be the one to end up killing the Night King. Also, I think we have some, the fate of Jonny and Dany are probably decided, where we're reminded again and again throughout the show that good things never last.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is a doomed romance.
Is your course going to outlive the HBO series?
It's not, actually. I'm retiring. This is the last time I'm teaching it. I know.
Really?
I know. Yeah. I think like good shows, this course has been fabulous, but it's also, proverbially, run its course after the series ends. Time to move on.
Jana Matthews is Associate Professor of Medieval Literature at Rollins College. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to help bring you the conversations and reporting you hear on Intersection. Your contributions support our in-depth local programming, whether it's deep dive political analysis, investigative reporting on the environment and healthcare, spaceflight and education, or conversations with Central Florida filmmakers, authors, artists, and musicians. Support our Spring Silent Drive by renewing your annual contribution or making an additional gift of support. And if you're not a member of WMFE yet, make that first step and become a sustaining member. Call 1-800-785-2020 or visit wmfe.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.